बिहारी जय गोपी जनवाला गिरिवरदारी जय गोपी जनवाला गिरिवरदारी यशोरनंदन व्रज जनरंजन यशोरनंदन व्रज जनरंजन जमुना तीरवन चारी जमुना तीरवन चारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, text 5. So I'll read the Sanskrit, a translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Udaret atmanatmanam natmanam avasadayet Atmaiva hyatmano bandur atmaiva ripu atmanaha. Udaret. One must deliver. Atmana. By the mind. Atmananam. The conditioned soul. Na. Never. Atmananam. The conditioned soul. Avasadayet. Put into degradation. Atma. Mind. Eva. Certainly. He. Indeed. Atmana. Of the conditioned soul. Bandhu. Friend. Atma. Mind. Eva. Certainly. Ripu. Enemy. Atmanaha. Of the conditioned soul. Translation. One must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. Purport. The word Atma denotes body, mind, and soul, depending upon the different circumstances. In the yoga system, the mind and the conditioned soul are especially important. Since the mind is the central point of yoga practice, Atma refers here to the mind. The purpose of the yoga system is to control the mind and to draw it away from attachment to sense objects. It is stressed herein that the mind must be so trained that it can deliver the conditioned soul from the mire of nescience. In material existence, one is subjected to the influence of the mind and the senses. In fact, the pure soul is entangled in the material world because the mind is involved with the false ego, which desires to lord it over material nature. Therefore, the mind should be trained so that it will not be attracted by the glitter of material nature. And in this way, the conditioned soul may be saved. One should not degrade oneself by attraction to sense objects. The more one is attracted by sense objects, the more one becomes entangled in material existence. The best way to disentangle oneself is to always engage the mind in Krishna consciousness. The word he is used for emphasizing this point, that one must do this. It is also said, mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo bandhaya vishaya sango mukta nirvashayam manaha. For man, mind is the cause of bondage and mind is the cause of liberation. Mind absorbed in sense objects is the cause of bondage, and mind detached from the sense objects is the cause of liberation. Amrita Bindu Upanishad. Therefore, the mind, which is always engaged in Krishna consciousness, is the cause of supreme liberation. Omakyan timarandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatan Sahagana Raganatan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Padijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakanvitamscha. He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dino Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanjana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpa Turubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadada Shivasade Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So beg for the blessings of the assembled devotees. May our words be aligned with Guru Parampara. May Shishi Radhe Sham be pleased with our desire to come together and hear Bhagavad Gita. May all the devotees be benefited by hearing from this transcendental book, Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Hare Krishna. So again, just reading this verse. This is chapter 6, text 5. One must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and his enemy as well. So this chapter is called, sixth chapter is called Dhyana Yoga. And Dhyana, the verbal, the Sanskrit root is D, D-H-I, of Dhyana. which means, sometimes it means mind, sometimes it means concentration or meditation. So Dhyana Yoga is like the yoga of meditation, using the mind in that way. You know, Dhyan, when this knowledge of Dhyan Yoga spread to China, then the word for meditation in Chinese, of course, is Chan, almost the same word. And then also in some parts of China, they would call it Chen. So then when this spread to Japan, it became Zen. So we've heard of Zen also means meditation. So the source of this is Dhyana Yoga, and it's spread through different parts of the world, and the name has slightly changed, but you can see the similarity coming from the Sanskrit Dhyan. And this sixth chapter, corresponds to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, more or less corresponds to it. It's like a brief version of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And we know meditation means it's a form of mental discipline. If we're serious about spiritual life, there has to be some form of mental discipline. You know, otherwise, then we can just be religious. You know, there are so many people who are just religious in a conventional way, with no real practice, with no real sadhana, with no understanding of controlling the mind. And this won't get us very far. You know, we have to become yogis. Yogis are like athletes. You know, to become a good athlete, if you're serious, to become a real athlete, you consider all parts of your life to be able to achieve your goal. What's the food that I eat? What kind of people am I around? What's the attitude that I have? What's, you know, my association? What's the lifestyle that I live? To be a very high-level athlete, all of these things are considered. So devotees, we're yogis, bhakti yoga. So we should also consider the food, the association, the lifestyle. All this is really showing the sign that someone is actually on the spiritual path. Otherwise, if we're just religiousness in this world can be just another form of material life. You know? You just have your life and you add a little, you know, religion to it, or sometimes you go to church or temple or mosque, and then you go back home and you live your life, you have your job, you have your family. It just becomes another part of material life. You're just adding something else into it. Little piety, you know. But yogi means, no, how am I living? What am I eating? What am I doing? Who am I associating with? So Bhagavad Gita is primarily a book on yoga. And as Prabhupada mentions in this purport, specifically this yoga, two things are very important. It says here in this verse, Atma, Atmanam. And these are translated as the mind and the soul and the Atma. These are the two most essential things to understand in yoga. I have a mind and I'm a soul, actually. Atma, Atmanam. There's a story in the 11th canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, there were four great renunciates named the four Kumaras. And they approached their spiritual master, Lord Brahma, and they asked him a question. They said that we're practicing yoga, so we understand it's necessary to separate the mind from the sense objects. We understand this is the point of yoga. But it seems to us that the mind naturally goes to the sense objects. And also the sense objects, through the senses, enter the mind of the person. And this seemed just like very mutual, very natural. So how can we achieve perfection in yoga when it seems like the mind and the sense objects are just naturally connected to each other? Right? This is a good question. It's a deep question. It seems simple. But whatever our mind dwells on, whatever that is, also gets back into the mind, and there's a kind of exchange. It's very natural. You think about your senses, and then all the sense objects that exist in this world, there's like a natural fit. It's like a hand. When you see a glove, you think, oh, a hand should go in there. Right? It's made for that. So when you see all these sense objects, all the different flavors of food, and we have this tongue, and all the different flavors that can please the tongue. So the question is, these things are practically made for each other. So to achieve perfection in yoga, how is it possible to separate the mind from the sense objects? That's the question to Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma, he starts to think about it for a moment, and he takes kind of a long time, he's thinking. And he says, actually, I can't answer this question. Even my mind, I'm engaged in creation, and my mind is also dwelling on sense objects. And so I'm not sure, if I cannot do it, if I'm not able to do it, how can I give an answer to you? So I also see that I have a mind that's also absorbed in these things. So he wasn't able to answer. And just at that time, there was a bright, brilliant light. And the four Kumaras saw this light, and Lord Brahma saw this light. And it was a form of the Lord, a very special and interesting and beautiful form of the Lord, where he appeared as a beautiful white swan, a Hamsa avatar. And they were all amazed, and they said, "Who are you?" And Hamsa avatar, he came there to enlighten them. They say the swan has this special ability. You've heard this, right, from Srila Prabhupada. The swan, if it has some water and there's some milk mixed, the swan can remove the milk and leave the water. So it has an ability to extract the essence. And so the swan avatar here, seeing the confusion here at this question and there's no answer, he came to give the essence. He came to separate the confusion, the confused situation, and to give the truth, to enlighten everyone. So it's very interesting what he says. So here's the answer. The question again is, how to separate the mind from the sense objects, because this is necessary for yoga. And the swan avatar says, "You're thinking that yoga means to detach the mind from the sense objects, but that's not yoga. Yoga means to detach you from your mind." You see the subtlety there? Which we're struggling with the sense of, my mind is attached, I gotta break this attachment. But he's saying, no, that's not the struggle. The struggle is to detach you from your mind. And then automatically, the inclination towards the sense objects will lessen, and gradually one can lose that attraction. So that story, this Prabhupada says the most and two important things in this purport are the for yoga, Atma, the soul, and Atma here, the mind, and Atmananam means the soul. And this is where the issue is, the mind and the soul. So how do we use, what is this mind? The mind was originally meant to be a tool for the self, a tool for the Atma. But presently the mind has usurped that higher position and is leading us. It's meant to be just a tool. You know, the soul is meant to be the leader. It's like, you know, the Bhagavad Gita gives this hierarchy. Atma, the soul, intelligence, mind, senses. And it's meant to be, from the Atma is meant to use everything else for its purposes. But the present situation is that the mind has usurped the authority. The mind has become the one who's in the highest position. So the tool has now become the master, the leader. It's like Dhritarashtra. Dhritarashtra, you know, means the one who holds the kingdom. Dhritarashtra. He's holding on to the kingdom. He's not meant to be the king, but he's holding that position. So the mind is like that. Also, the body with all its different components is also like a kingdom. And the self, the true self, is meant to be at the top, the king, if you like, and then using all the other subjects and citizens for, you know, various purposes. That's why we call Swami Maharaj. means great king. Why do we call a Swami a great king? Because the king, the self is like a kingdom. And Maharaj is just like the word Goswami, means master of the senses. So Maharaj also, in the same way, king of the kingdom, king of the senses, the mind, everything. They've overcome all that and they have the position. The Atma is the king. So therefore also Goswami means to be the master of the senses. So the mind is meant to be like an instrument, a tool, but it's living its own life as if it's the real self. You know? It's living a life of its own. And it comes to its own conclusions. And that's why sometimes it's called the enemy. That kind of mind is the enemy. When it's completely in charge of everything. You can see the mind is actually in charge. What is the mind? The mind means the desire body. All these different, you know, it has desire. So why we do anything in this world, even when we have intellectual ideas, what's really driving, even behind our ideas, what's driving it is a certain desire. You know, if you have great atheistic arguments, there's something deeper going on there. There's a desire to actually deny God, and then you come up with the arguments. Then the intelligence starts working for you. But deep in the heart, there's a resistance to God. There's a desire to avoid God. And then comes the intelligence and all the actions that we do. So the desire, the mind, is actually the ruler of each person in this material world in the conditioned state. It's behind everything. And there's this verse. This is from another verse about the mind. From the fifth canto. Srimad Bhagavatam. It says here, this is 5th canto, 11th chapter, 16th verse. The soul's designation, the mind, is the cause of all tribulations in the material world. As long as this fact is unknown to the conditioned living entity, he has to accept the miserable condition of the material body and wander within this universe in different positions. So it says here, as long as this is unknown, so the mind is an enemy when we don't realize that actually it's the cause of my coming back to this material world again and again. Now, most people don't realize this. They just think I am the mind. And they come with their own conclusions. They decide their own way in life, their own path. They don't detect that in our present state, it's actually the enemy. You know? That's the most dangerous kind of enemy. The enemy that can't be detected. You know, like when Krishna was playing with his friends, they played one game. This is a game that they decided to play where there were three roles to this game. Some of the cowherd boys played the role of lambs. And then other cowherd boys played the role of thieves. So the thieves were to catch the lambs. You know, lambs are running away. They're all cowherd boys, but they're playing these three different roles. So the thieves are capturing the lambs, and then you have the police, and the police capture the thieves. So everybody's kind of chasing each other. So Krishna's playing this with his friends. And then one person appeared who was not supposed to be there, but he disguised himself like a cowherd boy. The demon Vyomasura. And Krishna, what role do you think Krishna took? Those three roles. What role did Krishna take? Anyone know?
Defeated police.
Huh? Defeated police. Well, not in this game. In this game, he's playing one of the roles. There's the three roles. There's the lambs, there's the thieves, and there's the police. So in this game, Krishna took the position of police. And this was purposeful. Because he knew a demon was going to come into this game, and that demon took the role of thief. You know, so this is the idea. This demon, disguised as a cowherd boy, he was playing this role as a thief. So he was capturing all the cowherd boys who were playing lambs. But instead of just playing with them, I've caught you, he brought them to a mountain. And there was a huge hole in this mountain and a cave. You know, and he put them all in the cave and he sealed the cave with a giant boulder. And this way he was capturing all the cowherd boys, and his plan was to kill them all. So Krishna, of course, knowing what's happening in the role of the police, he understands that this thief is actually a demon. Now I will capture him and I will kill him before he can kill all of my friends. So Krishna caught hold of this thief, who was actually a demon, and he killed him. So one of the meanings of this story is that, you see, the cowherd boys, because they trusted that this was just another cowherd boy playing with us. They took an enemy as a friend. That was the mistake. It was actually an enemy, but they couldn't detect that. They took the enemy as a friend. So this is what we do with our minds. We don't see the mind as an enemy. We're just satisfied with our minds. We think it's our friend. And that's the most dangerous situation. So, you know, if you think about it, we're very satisfied with the minds that we have. We think, you know, yeah, of course, I'm not perfect, but my mind, for the most part, is reliable. I can figure things out. It's trustworthy. I have intelligence that I use. And we have a kind of self-confidence in ourselves. So that self-confidence in spiritual life, it should begin to shatter in some ways. You know, it should shatter. Because the mind can do many things, but what it can't do is reach the spiritual level on its own. So we have to, realizing that, we see that my mind is incapable of reaching the spiritual goal that I have. And so, you know, we need to be shaken out of that comfort sometimes. I remember when I was first reading Bhagavad Gita, I thought I would just read Bhagavad Gita because I was interested. This is an interesting book, and let me understand what the teachings are. But when I was reading it, and I kept reading the purports, I just remember being so confronted. Like Prabhupada, in every purport, is asking you that, you know, actually, you are spoiling your life. You have to surrender to God. You know, purport after purport, I'm reading that. I was thinking, I just wanted to learn the teachings of the Gita, and I feel like this person in every purport is just telling me I'm a fool and I need to surrender and I have it all wrong. I don't know anything. You have to hear from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. We are totally ignorant. And it was strange because I was attracted, but I kept... It was like the way Prabhupada describes good chutney. You know, it's... What does he say? It's so sweet you can't resist it. But it's also so spicy. So it's like you want to taste it, but it's also spicy. So I could not resist going back to the Bhagavad Gita, but all these purports were shaking me out of my comfort, my confidence in my own, you know, I'll figure out my own life in my own way. And that's important. The mind, we're very comfortable with it. Even Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, you know, he was so elevated. Even before he took initiation from Gaurakishore Das Babaji, he was known to be so upright with his character, so much integrity, so knowledgeable, so intelligent. And he was told by his father, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that you have to take initiation from a real guru, bona fide guru, and there is this Gaurakishore Das Babaji. He will be the best person. He's a pure devotee. And Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, he writes about this, that he saw that, well, he's very renounced, but he's not so educated person. And he wondered about that. And he started to notice that when he came around Gaurakishore Das Babaji, Gaurakishore Das Babaji paid him no mind. All his intelligence, all his education, it was like nothing in his eyes. And then Bhaktisiddhanta, that began to shake his heart a little bit. He said he became jolted. I think that's the word. That this person was paying... everywhere else he got so much respect. You know, he was offered a position in the university, chair person of a whole department, and given so many opportunities. But here's this little simple man, Gaurakishore Das Babaji, who showed no interest whatsoever in all of that knowledge and his character, all that meant nothing. And this was like a shock to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And then he began to realize that Gaurakishore Das Babaji has something that I have no idea about, and I have to surrender to him, and I have to take initiation from him. And we know the story, there was some struggle to do that, and he was practically crying. You must give me initiation, I'll take my life if you don't give me initiation. And Gaurakishore Das Babaji finally gave him initiation. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, all this knowledge that I have, if you take all the literatures of the whole world, one instruction of Gaurakishore Das Babaji, one sentence outweighs all that knowledge. He is so powerful. Because of his detachment and his devotion, that just one sentence from him outweighs all the knowledge of this world. So, first, you know, when we understand this about our mind, there's a kind of clash. Okay, I'm a soul and there's a mind and there's a clash, but eventually these two have to work together. The Atma, the soul, and the mind, they have to cooperate. They have to become friendly, as what's mentioned here. Becoming friendly to each other. You know, so what's the task of the mind? How does the mind become friendly? What does that mean? You know, first we have to... The first thing, the mind has two parts of its mission. First, it has to develop itself. In life, right, we want a healthy mind. This is an important job of parents, that the children actually just have, not a perfect mind, you can't perfect the mind, but more or less healthy. So we develop the mind, you know, the mind has to cope with this world of matter. It has to learn certain things, it has to become healthy. It has to become objective as far as possible. This is the first half of the mission of the mind, is to just develop and strengthen itself. And then when we realize what spiritual life is truly about, we can nicely use that, everything that we've learned with our mind and what we develop, we could use that in spiritual life. You know, a good mind is necessary to achieve spiritual discernment. You know, the mind accumulates things, it classifies things, it assimilates what we've heard from Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So that's all very important. But the mind eventually has to see that just this, just the development of itself is insufficient to achieve the spiritual goal. Right? We get so much knowledge and we may naively conclude that now I've understood the teachings. Now I've understood the truth. But what is the truth? The truth is not a collection of ideas. The truth is like a divine, it's a divine energy or shakti or power of the Lord. The truth is not just information and ideas that we accumulate. It's actually another order of existence. It's the divine shakti, the chit shakti, the daivi shakti, the divine energy. Jnana Shakti. It's always called Shakti because it's more than just words and information. It's actually a power, an energy. So sometimes we think, I know the Bhagavatam, I know the Gita, because we can explain certain things. But the mind has to also see. The mind can be tricked and think, well, now I've got it. But then there's still the second half of the mind's mission, which is now realizing that even with all this knowledge, it seems I'm still not purified. I'm still not changing so much, right? You ever have this thought? After so many years of Krishna consciousness, devotional service, we've learned so much, but still it feels like I'm still blocked off from a true change of heart. That's important, because now the mind has to do its other duty, which is to now surrender. You know, it has to, it almost like its whole life, it's building itself up, it's developing, it's getting stronger, it's getting healthy. But now there's a stage where it actually has to let go of everything and simply trust and the Supreme Lord and the Lord's devotees take shelter and surrender to the holy name, that higher energy has to enter into the mind. The mind can't reach it. You know, it's not like we're progressing, and the mind's just getting more and more developed, and then I'm spiritual. No, the mind comes to a threshold, realizing even with all this knowledge, all this development, I can't break through into the spiritual world. I can't, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur used to say this also, that you cannot storm into the spiritual world by your own willpower or by your own mind, by the efforts of the mind. So the mind has these two parts to its mission. First of all, develop, accumulate knowledge, learn things. You know, we make efforts, we try our best to be sincere, all that is necessary. And that's meant to bring us to a point where we also continue to realize this is insufficient. Something else is needed. And we completely surrender to the Lord, which is like opening the heart to this spiritual energy which has to descend. Our process is a process of descending, not ascending. You know? Like someone's building something, they're ascending, building higher and higher. But our process is we build somewhat, we have to do our part, and then you have to completely surrender and open yourself and beg for the mercy of the Lord to enter your heart to truly change you. This story is there's a story about this as well in Bhagavatam, with the story of Narada Muni. Narada Muni, he's sitting in meditation. So this chapter is about meditation. He's also sitting in a meditation, but it says his meditation is not just the meditation of an ascetic or a yogi who's just concentrating on the Atma. It said that his meditation had bhava, had love for the Lord. And so he's sitting in meditation, and suddenly the Lord appears to him, and then disappears. And so Narada Muni said, I had him. He was right there, saw the Lord. He became so ecstatic and enlivened. All his senses became enlivened. His mind became purified, everything, but then gone a moment later. So Narada Muni, he thought, okay, then let me do it again. Let me sit in meditation. Again, concentrate, love, concentration, focus, but nothing was happening this time. He couldn't do it. He couldn't again see the Lord. That shows us that it wasn't the meditation that caused the Lord to appear. The Lord came from his own sweet will. He was pleased with Narada Muni and showed up, but he also disappeared. And with Narada Muni trying the same method, he tried the same method to again see the Lord, but the Lord did not appear. Where the Lord spoke to him and said, you will not see me again. But I do this to you just so that you will hanker for me and you will long for me, and that longing will purify your heart. And when your heart is purified, you'll always be with me. Well, sometimes we have this question. We have nice experiences of Krishna in our spiritual life. We have moments of enlightenment. We have moments of mercy, and then they're gone. Why does Krishna do that? So that we can long for that reappearance. But we should know there's nothing I can do to get it, but I can long for it, and I can continue on with my service, continue on with my efforts, continue on with my sincerity, and just patiently wait for the Lord to bestow His mercy. So the mind has to learn this lesson. The mind, yes, develop, you make efforts, you do all of that, and you finally you have to completely surrender and realize that I cannot do it. So when we start to long for the Lord in this way, what's simultaneously happening is we're separating from the conditioned mind. That separation is becoming more and more distinct. And the material mind will go on with all its inclinations and thoughts, but now there's something else rising up within you, a longing for God. And so there's like a split. You know, you become two. I'm just identified with the mind, I'm just one. But now there's another part of me that longs for God, and there's still this mind that gives me trouble sometimes. You start taking that less seriously. So even when the mind falls into a bad habit or goes back to its old ways of thinking, You can say, oh, that's just the mind doing its thing. Now let me bring the mind back to the lotus feet of Krishna. Krishna advises this also in the same sixth chapter. I think it's the 26th verse. I'll just read about bringing the mind back again and again. This is what's necessary. 6:26, yes. From wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, one must certainly withdraw it and bring it back under the control of the self. You see, again, this verse also distinguishes the difference between the mind and the self. We have to feel that difference within us. I'm not all mind. There's also a true being. There's also the true self, and I have to start to direct the mind. Oh, there goes my mind in this direction. Let me now bring it back to the self. The self is supposed to be in control here. And let me tell my mind, now you go to the lotus feet of Krishna. This is constant practice of a devotee, you know? Just like we're all sitting here now. So we're listening. So the mind will wander. And there goes my mind. And then don't be too harsh on yourself. You just realize that's what it does. But now let me wake up and come back. Let me hear what Bhagavad Gita is saying. Right? Or we're taking prasadam. Where does the mind go? All over the place. I mean, you have to bring the mind back sometimes. Wow, this is offered to the Lord. Prasad means mercy. Let me eat this knowing that I'm receiving the mercy. I remember one sannyasi came to New York and I was asked to do a little service for him, and I brought him some khichdi. And this is Purnachandra Swami, who passed away. But I remember bringing him prasad one time, and he was just sitting there in a corner alone, and he was eating it, and he was saying, "There's so much mercy in this prasad, just the vegetables. Krishna's created such nice vegetables," and he's eating it, and he's just looking at it. I was like, this is how you honor prasad. I was amazed. You know, he kept commenting on, wow, Krishna is so amazing. Look at the colors, the smell, the flavors. Krishna is so amazing. And he's accepted it, and now I'm eating it. And, you know, even seeing, like, I think Borijan Prabhu also mentioned one story of seeing a devotee who was eating and his tears were falling in to the prasadam as he's eating, honoring it in that way. So the mind will forget this again and again, going so many different directions. But the practice bring it back. Oh, let me wake up to what's happening here. We're talking with devotees. So we have to spy on ourselves throughout the day. Spy on yourself. What is the mind doing right now? You know, if someone gave you an assignment, you have to spy on this particular person all day long. And I want you to record all of his actions and everything he says, observe his behavior. You know, that's your assignment. So we would do that, or you watch this person, you see how they talk, how they act, how they move, what they do. We have to spy on ourselves in that way. And also it has to be detached in that same way. If it's another person, you're detached, right? You don't really care what they do or say, you're just getting information. So we should also spy on ourselves in that way. Don't get too worried about what the mind is doing, but you observe the mind. Oh, it's doing this now. Now I'm thinking this. How crazy is this thought? Okay, let me bring it back to Krishna. You know, that practice throughout the day will help you with chanting. Because what is chanting? We have to be attentive to the holy name. And being attentive to the holy name will also help us with this practice throughout the day. So they help each other. It's all a practice in attention to bringing the mind back to Krishna. This is yoga. This is what it means to be a yogi. You know? A yogi. Disciplined. Discipline of the mind. Bring the mind back. So we can do all, you know, the devotional activities, but we want our minds to also be there. Prabhupada said that in one place. He said, devotee means the mind. What he meant by that is that in the actions of service, the mind is also nicely concentrated. If it's just the service, but the mind is somewhere else. So this is a practice. And don't expect that you'll perfect this practice, but you're going to learn through this practice that We cannot, we're completely dependent on Krishna's mercy. So more and more we beg for that and we long for that. So we can go on with our sincere efforts and at the same time realize the powerlessness of our mind to achieve perfection. And then we keep returning to this attitude of surrender. Like a constant, eventually it's going to be like a constant state of surrender. Someone gave class here recently and was mentioning that Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we'll end with this point. They asked him a question once. When will we become pure devotees? We're trying, we're doing so many things. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, interesting comment, he said that even when it happens, you will not know that it happened. Even you become a pure devotee, you're not thinking, nah, I just became a pure devotee. But it's kind of seamless that suddenly your mind is just spontaneously flowing towards the Lord. Maybe you take it very humbly that I'm still a fallen soul, I'm dependent on the mercy, you'll speak in that way and act in that way. But actually the mind now has shifted. You've shifted your identity from the mind to the soul, to the Atma. And what is the soul? The soul is an eternal servant of Krishna. So you're simply living in that. And it just makes me think a person becomes so innocent that they don't even know they're a pure devotee. Their minds have just become so sanctified and suddenly they're just acting with a nice constant remembrance of the Lord. They don't think I'm now a pure devotee. They're just like an innocent child who just has spontaneous attraction to the lotus feet of the Lord, and they encourage others, and they keep their mind nicely focused. They don't criticize. They don't get lost in so many other distractions. They're just in that flow of grace. So this is what's possible for all of us. But we have to practice now and also realize the limitations of the mind and the need to surrender. Therefore, Krishna ends this chapter. You know, he tells Arjuna, become a yogi. He tells all of us to become yogis. And the best of all yogis is the devotee who's always thinking of me within their heart, has faith in me. That yogi, Yukta Tamaha, is the greatest of all yogis. So, thank you so much for your attention. We'll have a few minutes if anyone has any thoughts, comments, reflections, questions. Hare Krishna. Jai.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Very nice class. Mm-hmm. The process of thinking in the mind is, there's three processes of thinking, feeling, and willing.
Yeah.
So the different points you have different obligations, I would guess.
Yeah.
So if you're still thinking, you can adjust for it, but if you get past that, it's difficult. So the willing is what brings the final fruition, I basically think so. What's the best way to monitor that before it gets out of control?
What's the best way to? What was that?
Oh, the best thing to monitor and control your mind so that it doesn't go past those stages. If you keep it thinking, you can adjust, but then once you get into feeling and willing,
yeah.
It's very difficult to retract.
Yeah, the mind has these three functions, thinking, feeling, and willing. Thinking we have some control over, some willing we have some control over, but feeling we don't. And it's interesting because feeling is what a bhakti is all about, love for God, right? We can't command ourselves to have love. But we can think certain things and we can do certain things. You know, the order of the spiritual master, let me align my will with that. That determination can be there. Even if I don't feel it, let me do it. So when you take the thinking, you can do something with it, so you do. The willing, you can do something with it, so you do. And these two together, they eventually will come by Krishna's grace, the feeling will start to change and we'll be doing it out of love rather than just, you know, our own reasons, our own purpose. So yeah, you're right. The feeling is the last thing to change, but we have some control over thinking and willing. Yes, Prabhu.
The verse that you picked in the beginning says, Uddharet atma, atma atmanayam. So it's not that we can be escaping from the mind. Krishna says, you have to deliver yourself with the help of mind. So mind cannot be rejected or should be kind of condemned. Then I was thinking in Harinam Chintamani, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains, because we have a Holy Name festival coming, that how actually the result of chanting is produced. We all are chanting, but how the result is produced. So then he quoted, if I recall, he says, Bhaktamukhe aisenam goloko hoite. So when the devotee has a devotional service attitude, then holy name descend from Golok Vrindavan. Bhaktamukhe aisenam goloko hoite. Dehobepi nache jibbadite. So then from Golok Vrindavan, the holy name came to the soul, and then the soul has to connect the tongue, which is physical, but soul cannot connect the tongue without mind. Because the route the soul has to the physical body, the tongue, is through the subtle body, through the mind. So mind has to be kind of a blend in with the holy name. Then the tongue will chant and then the mind will be delivered. Mind should not be overlooked separately. Just devotee should be chanting, and then with that service attitude, then the mind will be automatically your best friend, and mind will actually help you to deliver.
Very nice. Yeah, the relationship. There's a relationship between the soul, the mind, the body, and it has to be harmonious. They have to cooperate. They have to understand each other and cooperate with each other. Something like that, right? You cannot just, like you said, just completely kill the mind, remove the mind, but it's part of this process. Yeah, that's perfect, because the verse is saying to become friends. Friends means a friendly relationship.
Yes.
Not that you kill your friend. Yes. Thank you, Prabhu.
Krishna. So at one point you said that the mind is a tool and that we should make it healthy, not be weak. And I feel like you were getting there, you were talking about what it means to have a healthy mind at the end. But I guess I'm wondering, what is a healthy mind and what is a weak mind? What is an unhealthy mind and a weak and unhealthy mind? And what is a strong and healthy mind? And what are the symptoms of that? So what does that, what does it look like? What are the symptoms of that?
Healthy mind. Yes, so we can understand from Bhagavad Gita, healthy mind means what we hear about in terms of the mode of goodness. You know, the Bhagavad Gita is talking about ignorance, passion, and goodness. And it's always giving examples of certain things within these three modes. Happiness in the three modes. Determination in the three modes. Charity in the three modes. So whenever you see the verses that explain the mode of goodness, these actions, we can see a healthy mind. A healthy mind is able to discriminate. There's a certain objectivity. There's a certain integrity towards principles. You perform your duty. Duty is a big word. Duty detached from the results. All of this is pointing to a very healthy mind. And I was mentioning this is a big duty of the parents. The bringing up of children when they see this example. Because, you know, when you're a child, you're just, whatever is going to happen is going to influence you. So to start off with a healthy mind requires that, good parents live by spiritual principles and these things. And that's a good start. And then one should hear from, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra and understand the difference between the modes, and really understanding the mode of goodness. This is a healthy mind, the mode of, and it doesn't have to become perfect. So we shouldn't be discouraged. But more or less, it's important that there's a certain state of health so that we can understand things and understand how to actually take shelter, surrender. and shift into the identity of the spirit.
But doesn't that seem more like the function of intelligence to make those distinctions? Like what is good, what is bad, and intelligence.
Yes.
So the distinction maybe between the mind and intelligence.
Yeah, mind. You know, sometimes when Prabhupada says the mind, he means the whole subtle body. And then other times we break it into parts so that we can understand more. So when we talk about the mind, it can just be seen as a whole unit with different parts. Like also mentioned, thinking, feeling, willing, it's all the mind. But if you really break it down, you can kind of break it into other sections too. Actually, it's the intelligence does this, the mind does that. So when I was speaking of a healthy mind, I'm looking at the whole picture. You know, discrimination, yeah, that's intelligence. And at the same time, it's all the subtle body, and sometimes it's all referred to as mind. That's all. So we'll stop here. Thank you all so much. Srimad Bhagavad Gita Ki. Srila Prabhupada Ki.